but I also would like to say that integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. That brings me to this. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point? That would be another question.
I'm James Wyrick, and you're listening to Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who serve and protect our nation. Welcome to Episode 3 of Military Justice. Today we will be discussing unlawful command influence, specifically unlawful command influence in the Bergdahl case. On 28 September 2016, the military judge in the Bergdahl case dismissed the UCI motion that was filed by Bergdahl and his attorneys. I will post that 9-page decision on the Twitter feed for Military Justice, that is, at PodcastMJ. We are fortunate to have with us today a special guest, the JAG Defender, otherwise known as Brian Buffard. Today we'll be discussing with him the Bergdahl ruling, his prior dealings with UCI matters, and unlawful command influence in general. Brian is a fantastic lawyer, has been practicing for over 20 years, doing almost exclusively criminal law inside and outside of the military. In addition to his vast wealth of experience in military criminal issues, Brian has been an accomplished and long-serving friend of Wyrick. Our friendship goes back almost 20 years now, and it's a real pleasure to have him on the show today. In addition to our friendship professionally, socially, I also owe him a great debt. He saved me from a lifetime of mispronunciation. I had gone down the road of saying gravamen. Ladies and gentlemen, it's never gravamen. It's only gravamen. Without any further ado, here's my discussion with Brian Buffard. How many commanders are you currently representing who have been charged with violating the prohibition on unlawful command influence?
Well, you know what? That number would be zero.
So I'm sure you've had many in the past?
Actually, I have had zero in the past.
Oh, so this is a prohibition that doesn't go much enforced?
It is. I would compare it. If you leave the rarefied air of senior officers and commanders who have the ability to commit unlawful command influence, who are frankly never prosecuted for it. Another good example, you know, maybe down in the weeds would be, you know, wouldn't you expect that whenever there's a false allegation, there ought to be a prosecution for making a false allegation?
Right.
I've seen in my entire career, and that is getting out of law school, working at 5 years at Camp Pendleton, working as a DA for about 2 years and being a defense counsel for 10 solo, I have seen one case. Let me rephrase that. I have seen or even heard of one case in which that's happened.
Right.
That is somebody making a false allegation and getting a charge sheet for it.
And how many cases have you heard of UCI actually being prosecuted?
Zero.
That's zero.
I mean, how many have you heard of?
I think I'm there with you with zero. I believe, and I was reading a discussion on CAF log between Dwight Sullivan, Eugene Fidel, and I believe Fran Gilligan, and they were of the opinion that there had never been a prosecution for UCI. And
yeah.
I think you would agree. Those are three giants in our in the military justice sector. I wouldn't disagree with those three gentlemen.
no, there's no question. And I think you can go online and do a search, you know, on Lexis, and you're not going to find anything. You're going to find a lot of mention of UCI, and you're going to find a lot of cases that if you dig into what's going on, you can feel very confident that UCI was committed, but you never see a prosecution for it.
Well, and given the fact that I'm really kind of allowed to do anything I want on this podcast, I have kind of free reign as far as editorial control. I'm not sure why I picked Papa Panda Sexy Pants as our first case to discuss.
Well, there's probably a good reason for it.
But tell us about that case, if you would, a little.
That is the Sinclair case.
Now Lieutenant Colonel Sinclair, I believe.
Exactly. Former Brigadier General Sinclair. And, you know, Sinclair is an example. Well, Sinclair may be kind of an outlier just simply because, hey, he's a general officer who's being charged in the first place. And that might be the topic for another whole podcast of why don't we see prosecutions generally for senior officer misconduct that if committed by a lance corporal, that person's butt would be in a real sling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the issues we have is generally there's a preference, you know, it's not absolute, but generally there's a preference under the UCMJ to have jurors or members who are senior to the accused. So if you have a 1-star, you're only looking at 2, 3, and 4 stars as being members.
Sure. And if you keep that in the same branch of service, there's a real strong likelihood that they're all going to actually know each other.
Oh, and, absolutely.
You know, and might be strikeable off the panel for that basis. So yeah, there's a I think we're going a little bit far afield from the question you asked me, but yeah, there is a structural problem with holding senior officers accountable in the way we hold junior folks accountable for just that reason alone. You know, where are you going to get your members?
I agree, but I don't think we go too far afield with that, because in the Sinclair case, we have those same very senior officers up at the Pentagon who seem to have reached down and interfered with this trial. At least that's what the trial judge held.
Yeah, that's what he held. So, you know, the Sinclair case comes up right in the midst of a strong push by Congress and Congress basically pushing this on the senior leadership, which is, you know, some high profile cases of sexual assault, whether those were legitimate or not is a more of an open question. But it came to Congress's attention that this is a quote unquote problem. And, you know, when I say it like that, I want to be very clear that I'm not suggesting at all that sexual assault is not a problem. Any, you know, one sexual assault is absolutely one sexual assault too many.
Absolutely.
There's no question about that. And I don't know of anybody who disagrees with that view. The issue is not, is sexual assault bad? The issue is, or should be, is there something about the military, whether it's military life in general, whether it's military justice, you know, whatever it is there something about the military that makes it more likely that sexual assault is going to occur, or makes it more likely that the sexual assaults that occur are going to be more horrible, let's say, than the average number of sexual assaults that are going to occur in the population statistically anyway?
Well, then I think we can more generalize this, you know, to also include the Bergdahl case, that I think it's fair to say after about 2013, Congress is acutely aware of high-profile military justice cases, and it will not hesitate to get involved if they deem it necessary.
Right, and I think that's exactly right. There's this overarching sense of awareness of, hey, what's going on in legal cases in the military, and there's so many jumping off points from here, and I think one of maybe the more important ones is, you know, it harkens back to high school civics, okay, high school government class. We have separation of powers. We have an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch, and they all have different roles, and it's important that no one branch is overly powerful over the others. An interesting problem that frankly never occurred to me as a problem when I was on active duty, but certainly as a civilian defense counsel, it's a lot more obvious, is that we don't have, we have the same need for a separation of powers in this context between the judicial branch and the command. But the problem is that all of our judiciary is part of the executive branch. Okay. These are Article I judges, not Article III judges, where you would go and see, you know, the federal judiciary, which is truly independent.
Even to bring a finer point to that, yeah, even the other Article I judges, such as bankruptcy or some of the other Article I courts that are for a fixed term, usually a 15-year term, our judges in the military are even less protected than that. They have no fixed term at all.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, but they know, and we all know, that they're going to end up rotating back into the general judge advocate community. In the military, it's not like you're a judge forever and that's what you do. You're going to be a judge for a while, just like any other tour, and then you're going to go do something else. And so there, I think what that does is it gives Congress and certainly the executive a feeling of we can exert more control over these people and over this process than we should, and we can do it in a way that could never be done in the civilian community, or shouldn't ever be done in the civilian community. So I think that emboldens Congress to think that they can kind of tinker with things that they probably shouldn't be tinkering with, or shouldn't be tinkering with them in a way that creates the specter of unlawful influence.
Right, and that seems to have derailed at least part of, at least that was a portion of derailing the Sinclair case.
It was. So the issue in Sinclair, one of the issues in Sinclair, was that a plea offer was submitted, and the plea offer was rejected with pretty good reason to believe that it was rejected because of the pressure from Congress that, hey, we need to be tough on sexual assault. And unfortunately, when Congress says we need to be tough on sexual assault, it's not talking about being very rigorous to apply the presumption of innocence and the proper burden of proof, but rather, hey, we want results that show people are getting convicted because that's what our constituency wants to see. That's a huge problem, because if a senior officer with sufficiently little integrity believes that by taking a particular action in a court-martial, he can either improve his chances of promotion or harm his chances of promotion, there certainly are officers out there who are going to let that concern affect their decision-making.
The individual desire of a senior officer to move forward can be at the expense of real true justice for the accused.
Exactly. And I think even to the point where justice for the accused is almost not even a consideration. And I know how that sounds to say, and I'm ashamed that I have to say it, but I do. I mean, it is what I believe to be the truth. I think that by and large, politicians and less informed people, you know, in the electorate generally, feel that justice means people getting convicted and going to jail. And yes, sometimes it does mean that. Unfortunately, sometimes it doesn't. And it's an evidence-based decision that, in my opinion, should not be driven by any considerations other than, has the government proved this allegation beyond a reasonable doubt with proper evidence?
Right.
To me, that is the only issue that should ever be raised in any kind of a criminal case. And unfortunately, there are people who disagree. And I know we're going to keep talking about them here.
And I think, as you were talking about, we have that paradigm of a separation of powers, where you have that backstop that is the judge, who enjoys at least a long term of office, if not lifetime tenure.
Right.
But our military judges don't always get that same level of deference. I think that leads us right into the Salyer case.
Yeah, the Salyer case was also pretty interesting and pretty bold.
I think this is a real low point for the naval services, including Coast Guard, but especially for the Navy and Marine Corps. This was not a high point.
No, this was not our finest hour. And this also, again, in my opinion, is attributable to government overreaching and government arrogance. In other words, we're the government. We represent the interests of the command and the executive branch, and we're going to actually flex muscle over a military judge. And in this case, there was a military judge that basically the government went after, and in my opinion, did not go after for any kind of a proper reason, but instead he was somebody who, because of some concern on the part of the government that he would not be as helpful to them as perhaps they would like, they basically tried to run him out on a rail. And so they pulled his service record, and they got information that frankly they never should have been entitled to in the first place.
So the Salyer case is a child pornography case, and the trial judge makes a call on 17 to 18, depending on the age of
right. What was a minor?
Yeah, what was a minor for purposes of child pornography?
Right.
And instead of possibly taking an appeal on that case, what's the
right.
government do?
Yeah, that's the appropriate remedy. If you play fair, you put judges in there who are knowledgeable, and then you abide by their decisions. And if you don't like their decisions and you can appeal it, then you appeal it.
Yeah, you ask the higher level judges. That's the way we do it.
Right. And that is called the rule of law. and the rule of law is, protecting that is the entire reason why we have a military. But in this case, the government didn't do that. The government played dirty pool, and they got some information out that they believe to be scurrilous behavior on the part of the judge, which I think if you look at the facts, I don't think that it rises to that level at all. But maybe even more concerning is the staff judge advocate. The staff judge advocate is basically the command's lawyer. He had an inappropriate contact with the judge's boss, discussing the ruling and telling him that the government's going to move to disqualify the judge. And the judge at that point suggested that all of this that the government was doing constituted unlawful command influence. And, of course, ultimately the court agrees with that.
Well, and so we don't, I just want to clarify this for the listener, that what the government did is they went into the judge's personal files and suggested that he possibly started dating the woman who he eventually marries and has a number of children with, that they started dating it when she was the age of 17. It's
right.
Not even fully clear, but I can't.
And it's also not a crime.
Right. I can't imagine that that we should be combing through the personnel files and that happened to come out of his medical files to try to impeach judges. That doesn't seem to square well with the rule of law.
Exactly. And query if this particular judge were, what we refer to as a hanging judge or a pro-government judge, would they have done the same thing? And I think the answer is obviously no, they wouldn't have. They attacked him for what they appeared to believe would be a defense-friendly attitude, even though I've read the case, and I'm not convinced at all that Judge Morey had that attitude to begin with. But apparently the government thought that he did. But that whole case harkens back to a case that was going on when you and I were at Pendleton, the Lewis case, where again the government is trying to attack a judge, and they were ultimately able to get the judge to recuse herself, but they did it through unlawful means. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces said, yeah, by use of unlawful command influence, the government was essentially able to veto a particular judge. And they were successfully able to do that. And CAF said, no, we're not going to let that stand, and we're going to dismiss the case. And so that's what they did.
Well, and I think what's disturbing about all of that is there's no repercussion for any of these prosecutors. This is just, nothing happened there. There's no personal responsibility that they share for this, or at least that's imposed upon them.
Exactly. And I think there are lots of different reasons for that. But one of the reasons is we're asking people on the same team to judge that conduct. In other words, we're asking the government to prosecute another arm of the government that was acting on behalf of the government. And you just don't see that. You know, right. what you see is sort of the classic example of, well, we investigated ourselves and found we did nothing wrong.
Right.
And to me, that attitude really just has no place in a free society at all. And so having to deal with that in the context of any kind of criminal case where you actually have a real human being whose life is on the line, that is incredibly offensive and certainly incredibly stressful, not just for the client, but for the lawyer as well.
Well, and you can see that, you know, either in the first season of Serial, the second season of Undisclosed, or even the prosecution of Senator Ted Stevens, that these Brady violations by prosecutors usually go unremarked upon by the government, or they say, oh, it was inadvertent.
Right. And in the civilian world, well, you know, let me just speak to Texas. You know, right now we have recently, over the past couple of years, we had a case here. The defendant was named Michael Morton, and Michael Morton's prosecutor played dirty pool, and it got to be so egregious that we now have the Michael Morton Act in Texas that requires the state to provide discovery to the defense. And you would say, well, you know, why wasn't that the law already? And in a way it was. In other words, you could always go to the judge and argue for it, but it was never a pre-existing mandate in Texas, and now it is. And why is that? Why would it take something like that to make the government accept the fact that you've got to play fair? And if you're going to prosecute somebody, they have a right to see the evidence against them. That seems like a very basic truth, and certainly a truth that we enjoyed in military practice, although it did have its problems there. But it illustrates that breathtaking arrogance of government lawyers and government prosecutors and government law enforcement, that they can kind of just do whatever they want to the individual because, hey, he's a bad guy. You know, we've identified him as a bad guy, so therefore he must be a bad guy. Therefore, it's okay to do whatever we want to him.
And that if later it's found that, we may have withheld some information, we're going to be given the benefit of the doubt because it's our buddies that are investigating us.
Right. And we're only now starting to see the availability of meaningful sanctions against prosecutors who, for example, hide evidence.
Right.
I mean, you can tell it upsets me. I mean, it upsets me as an American.
As it should, yes.
You know, frankly. You know, just imagine the difference between somebody coming up to you with a pistol and putting that pistol to your head and ending your life. Okay? That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the ability of a government lawyer acting, you know, right in the light of day to take your life in much the same way, and perhaps even in a worse way, to consign someone to prison for the rest of their lives when there was exculpatory evidence that they knew about and didn't disclose. To me, there's very little difference between both those two examples.
Yeah, and one uses the stamp of approval of the government.
Right. One uses a gun and one uses the law. And man, that's not what the law is for, and that's not why the law was written, and that's certainly not what our founders envisioned would be happening, even though thankfully they gave us the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendments to help, you know, to help the individual in this process. But
you know, this is probably a good segue into, in your individual practice, have you run across unlawful command influence?
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely have. And you're probably talking about the Giles case.
Right.
That was a very interesting. It ended well, I suppose, in one sense, but it was a very unsatisfying ending. And the short version of this, and I'll try not to be quite so long-winded.
Oh, no, not at all. And I think I want to put a pin in that for a second, because what you said about it ended well in the long run, but not fully satisfying, I think that we lawyers, that's something definitely that we run into, that hey, it might be a good outcome for the client, but it might not seem like true justice for the entire process. And I know that there's always a tug there.
There is. And of course, when you're a defense counsel, you need to always act ethically and with professional responsibility and with zeal for your client. But that's where your loyalty lies. Your loyalty doesn't lie with the system. It certainly does not lie with the government writ large. It lies with that one individual whose life is quite literally, in some cases, in your hands. If you don't do your job, terrible things will happen to an individual who may be guilty, who may not. To me, it doesn't matter.
That's
whether somebody is guilty or not guilty does not absolve the government of its obligation to play fair and play by the rules. And so in this case, it was a case at Quantico, a young man who was charged with numerous sexual assaults, okay? Now, you hear that, and the knee-jerk reaction is to think, oh, that's horrible, that's a bad guy. Well, to give you an example, one of the more serious sexual assault allegations was placing his hand on another Marine's shoulder, okay? Fully clothed Marines, but placing his hand on another Marine's shoulder.
Right, right.
All right, so, you know, we have a charge sheet that has a bunch of allegations like that. There was nothing on that charge sheet that involved anybody's clothes coming off, any genital contact. I mean, it was not the typical sexual assault that you would think of as a sexual assault. But nevertheless, he's facing hundreds of years of potential confinement for this. As we are litigating this case, before I start talking about this, I do want to make clear. I don't have to make this clear, but I would like to. I'm not disparaging the personal motives of some of the people involved who I'm going to talk about, but I will lay out the facts and kind of let your listeners draw their own conclusions, because I certainly did. We began this case with a military judge who was a reservist, who was a fairly new military judge, but certainly qualified and certified and sworn and capable of handling this case, and a very nice lady. And we had a couple of hearings before her, and this case was going to kick off and be a more or less run-of-the-mill case. And then something very interesting happened that everybody knows about, but maybe everybody doesn't know, too many of the details, and that is the former Commandant of the Marine Corps, General James F. Amos, began a series of lectures, and he delivered these lectures quite literally to the entire Marine Corps. In other words, the only staff non-commissioned officer or officer who did not hear his speech live would be just because of an error in scheduling. Everybody was required to be there. General Amos toured the country and later toured the world to every Marine base and sat everybody down and talked to them. Okay.
These are in huge auditoriums. This is almost like a worldwide concert tour.
Oh yeah. It was, I'm sure it was very Joel Osteen like. And so is it permissible for the commandant to speak to all of his Marines? Well, absolutely it is. That's not the issue. Is it motivating for a commandant to come out live and speak with you directly? Yeah, absolutely it is. But that really underscores the importance of exactly what he's saying and why he's saying it. It also underscores the fact that the set of Marines who are staff NCOs and officers is the same set of Marines who will be able to serve on members' panels, military juries, okay? So the commandant is speaking to all of the people in the Marine Corps who would possibly ever come to sit on a court-martial as a fact finder, okay? And General Amos says a number of things, and some of those things are innocuous, telling people that they need to be good Marines, that's fine. But he made a series of statements that were directly related to what he viewed as an epidemic of sexual assault. And there was a way that he could have delivered that speech that would have been okay. In other words, would not have been unlawful command influence or would not have raised that question. But he made some specific statements referring to statistics, which I believe to this day, I've never seen valid statistics that that suggest what General Amos was saying. But essentially, he, during his briefings and in some follow-on written correspondence, told everybody in the Marine Corps that if there is an allegation of sexual assault, you don't have to know anything about the evidence to know that it is overwhelmingly likely that that allegation is true. Okay? So he's telling people, if you hear an allegation, you should immediately believe it without the necessity of looking into the details of that investigation, if there even was an investigation.
And if memory serves, it was somewhere, he quoted some number in the 80 percentile.
Well, he did. He originally quoted about 80%, but later on in some of his written correspondence that again went to, you know, it was widely disseminated in the Marine Corps, he used the figure of 92 to 98%. So for those reasons and for, you know, some other things that he said, we raised the issue of unlawful command influence.
And I think some of the other things he said may are also of note, that he seemed generally dissatisfied with the level of punishment that was being meted out by
members. That's for sure. And I shouldn't have overlooked that. But yeah, he was telling people, you know, I see these cases, they come across my desk, and I read these allegations, and then I see that they received this punishment that I think was too light, and basically just calling out the Marine Corps for allowing this situation to exist, that he wants to see more punishment. And of course the subtext is, yeah, I see these cases come across my desk that I don't like, and you know what else I see? I see who the members were that gave this weak punishment. If you are a Marine who is interested in your career, you're going to want to please higher. Hopefully you will do that in such a way that you can maintain your integrity. But there are some who won't. And there are some who might say, hey, I might not be personally convinced that this happened enough to convict this person, or I may not be convinced that this person who we found guilty deserves a harsh punishment, but you know what? The commandant wants to see it, and the commandant can crush my career. So here we go.
And to kind of bring this, to put a point on this for our civilian listeners, you know, just put yourself in the position of being accused of a crime in one of those perfectly little square counties they have in Texas, and Brian Buffard is defending you, so obviously you're in good hands. But the local district attorney has gone out and lectured at churches, community centers, your entire population of jurors, and said, you know, that we should be believing these crimes, we should be punishing them more, and I'm very disappointed in the low level of punishment that I've seen in the past.
That is a good example, but that doesn't go nearly far enough to address the relationship that the commandant has with these people. The local DA could go out there and try to poison the well, and that has happened. In fact, that's happening as we speak in these Twin Peaks cases. We're certainly addressing that with the courts. But
so it's actually the local DA that you all work for.
Yeah, imagine that the DA had the ability to negatively affect the lives of jurors who render results that he doesn't like. You know, we don't have that kind of scheme in the civilian world, but that's all the military is. I mean, that's what the military is. It is inherent ability to coerce people who are junior to you. Okay? And I'm not saying coercion's going on all the time. I'm saying the ability exists for somebody who might have integrity problems, as I personally believe that General Amos had and has, to play dirty pool. And that's exactly what he did. And so we had to deal with that in this case. So you might wonder why I brought up the circumstances of our military judge. Well, I bring that up because once we raised this issue that frankly any military judge is perfectly capable of handling under the law and handling appropriately, we got to a Article 39A session, a hearing one day, and found that our new judge from out of nowhere was Colonel Dougherty, who at that time was the chief judge of the entire Navy and Marine Corps trial judiciary. Again, draw your own conclusions from that, but he would now be handling the case. And, oh, look here, we now have a UCI motion involving the Commandant of the Marine Corps. I guess we better get down and handle this motion.
And so that second judge is able to just detail himself. He assigns the case to himself and removes it from that other judge.
That's correct. Normally, there should be a good reason why that would happen. And a good reason would not include, hey, the defense is raising a claim against higher authority. In other words, I'm quite serious when I say that any general court-martial certified judge is capable of handling this issue. Okay? The problem is that this was now a political issue.
Right, and in the normal case, the replacement of that judge are really for things that occur in the normal circumstances of life. Someone's
yes.
ill, someone's child, you know, is somewhere, someone's going on vacation, those type of things. Not something about the case in and of itself.
Right, and the explanation that we were given, this was all the explanation we were given, and there was really no way to necessarily dispute it. Was, hey, I had already planned on putting myself on this case, but I had a scheduling issue, and that's why I put the previous judge on there. But now my scheduling issue has resolved itself, and so I'm able to handle the case. I am not by any stretch impugning the words of Colonel Dougherty. That's what he said, and I accept it. Does it raise concerns about whether or not this had anything to do with his decision? Well, yeah, I think it does. I think and still believe that he came on the case primarily to deal with this issue, and so we did. And to an extent, it was a positive thing, because I think that he allowed us to have our hearing. He listened to our arguments. He accepted a lot of what we were saying, and he found, I believe for the first time in military history, or at least UCMJ history, that a sitting service chief, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, had in fact committed unlawful command influence, at least apparent unlawful command influence. And so we dealt with that. We were pushing very hard to have the Commandant brought in and placed under oath, as we would do with any Lance Corporal who needed to testify, as we do with convening authorities from time to time. If there's an issue that comes up, sometimes they will have to come in and testify about some of their actions in a case. I believed and still absolutely believe that the Commandant himself should have been put under oath and essentially questioned about everything that was going on behind the scenes with the Heritage Brief. And I believe that because it's not just enough to find that there's unlawful command influence. There needs to be some kind of remedy for that. And we were never able to achieve any kind of a meaningful remedy. And so I feel like we were, you know, kind of tossed a bone and got the ruling, but the ruling was essentially toothless.
Yeah, and I think that this is a time that we really should, you know, give a certain amount of credit to our Army brethren. In the Bergdahl case, the judge in that case did have General Abrams, the convening authority, testify in open court about the statements made by Senator McCain.
Right, and the effect that those would have on him, or he denied an effect that those would have on him. But again, I think just an objective observer, if your boss wants something, and you don't give your boss what he wants, there might be repercussions from that. And just to deny that there would be repercussions, I think is pretty disingenuous.
Yeah, and I think that's a good time to turn to the Bergdahl ruling that we're here to discuss, and explain for our listeners that Senator McCain is really the boss of bosses, that he is. He's a maverick that's been in Washington since, what, the early 80s?
Yeah.
And he currently now sits on as the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. That is the committee through which all important service matters flow, including the promotion of generals. General officers are put forth on a slate One and two stars are usually voted on, I think, as a block. Three and four stars are voted on individually, and they first have to go through the Senate Armed Services Committee. And that was the basis for the Bergdahl challenge for unlawful command influence when Senator McCain had come forward and said, if there's not punishment in the Bergdahl case, I will be holding a SASC hearing. So that, as you've mentioned before, that's that indirect pressure on the convening authority. If that convening authority doesn't ensure at least a general court-martial to go forward to a general court-martial, that there will be a hearing.
Exactly. And to add to that, the other sort of important thing to know about that particular issue is this case had gone to an Article 32 investigation. And while an Article 32 investigation is not binding on the convening authority, it's essentially a speed bump on the way to a referral.
That's sometimes discussed as being similar to a grand jury indictment, but it seems that it's a little different in that it can be overruled, correct?
Exactly. Any felony case, felonies being crimes under state law that you can get for that you can be imprisoned for more than 1 year as a potential punishment, are analogous to crimes that are sent in the military to a general court-martial. If a case is going to a general court-martial, there will be the likelihood or the possibility of punishment for over a year, and in some cases, you know, dozens and dozens of years. In the civilian world, it is an absolute prerequisite before you can take a felony case to trial. A grand jury has to look at it and determine whether or not there's probable cause that an offense was committed and that the defendant or the accused committed it. If they agree that there was, then they issue what's called a true bill of indictment. Now that case is indicted, it can go forward. But if they don't think that there's probable cause, for whatever reason, they can issue what's called a no bill. And that kills that case.
Give a reason. Is that correct?
No, that's right. They don't. And there are ways that the government can sometimes get around a no bill, but generally speaking, that ends that case.
Right.
Okay. I wish that an Article 32 were more analogous to a grand jury, because that's the first time that you're having a hopefully independent lawyer, that is a legally trained person, a judge advocate, take a look at the evidence and see, okay, is there really anything here? Or what kind of punishment does this case rate? And so, you know, for all the news reports and everything swirling around the Bergdahl case and all of the high emotions on all sides, this officer, I believe is Lieutenant Colonel Visker, he looked at this and he determined, you know what? Yeah, this case can go forward, but it's not a felony level case. This case ought to be handled at a special court-martial, and more than that, based on everything I've heard, the punishment should be limited. He shouldn't even be able to get a bad conduct discharge for this. You know, he a legally trained person, took into account the evidence and the issues in the case. He was not driven by politics. He was not driven by the need to send a message to the general public or to Congress. He, in my opinion, was doing his job as a judge advocate.
And I don't know the individual personally, but we can surmise that as a lieutenant colonel in the Army, judge advocate, he's been practicing for at least 15 years, I would say.
Yeah, he certainly knows what he's doing. And he's been advising, you know, he's probably been an SJA before, he's advised commands. He's probably been either a trial or defense counsel or both, you know, by the time you reach 05. So, you know, and he was appointed to be the 32 officer. You know, they try not to appoint, you know, people who without good judgment into that position.
In fairness, so, I've been appointed to be that.
Yeah, I have too, actually.
Okay.
But anyway, he makes a very strong statement that this case, while serious, is not so serious that it needs to be at a GCM with, you know, the potential for life in prison and such as that. Well, the convening authority ignores that.
To put a point on that for a second, yeah. I know that I've talked to a number of our mutual colleagues. I can't recall ever seeing a Article 32 investigation report that made that type of recommendation. Do you?
I have seen it, but it's pretty rare, obviously. Right. I mean, most, and this is as it should be, you know, most cases that get charged should have probable cause.
Right.
If there's not probable cause that something happened, the fact that that person's been charged is a huge problem to begin with. So, you know, even as a defense attorney, it's not like I am upset by the idea that, you know, cases can get charged and go to trial. I mean, in a perfect world, the government would justly win all their cases because they would only charge people for whom they can prove a case beyond reasonable doubt. In reality, that's not the way it is. And that's why, you know, I do what I do. But the convening authority ignores that recommendation, which the law allows him to do. But, you know, one of the concerns that I have is that, and we can see this in what happened later on and the litigation that's going on right now, is that maybe he was thinking about things that really aren't relevant to whether or not Sergeant Bergdahl is guilty or not guilty of this offense or deserves a light or a serious punishment. So you mentioned that Senator McCain is the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He is maybe the most powerful person to decide whether somebody with 2 stars gets a 3rd star or 3 stars gets a 4th star.
Or a 4-star gets another job.
Or a 4-star gets another job. So he's definitely somebody that if you are a careerist general officer, which I believe is probably, you know, kind of
that
obvious.
That Venn diagram has very little, has almost perfect overlap.
Yeah. You've got to have a ton of integrity to be able to say, you know what, at some personal risk to myself, I'm going to do the right thing here. Okay. And it's sad when we find that we have elevated people to that position who don't have that kind of integrity, particularly when it's possible to do it right. It's possible to promote the right kind of person. And I don't want to get too far afield here, but I think you and I would both agree that Lieutenant General Waldhauser, United States Marine Corps, is one of those people.
Absolutely.
He's one of those people who put his personal interests aside to do the right thing. And we can, you know, that might be the subject for a Heritage Brief focused podcast. I know I just sort of touched on it a little bit. But.
And General Waldhauser is actually that's a great outcome for the entire system. He goes on to become a 4-star and the head of AFRICOM. But yes,
yep.
That we will have you back for that, Brian. Don't think you're getting away.
And I'm so happy to hear that about General Waldhauser because he is the kind of person with the integrity who needs to be a major leader in our military. We have seen other examples of people who were not as lucky as Lieutenant General Waldhauser. General Franklin and General Helms in the Air Force, for example, what happened to them is precisely why somebody like General Abrams in the Bergdahl case might actually think that he could have a problem if he doesn't do what pleases Congress.
Before we go into those two cases, I want to read one particularly troubling portion from the judge's ruling in the Bergdahl case.
Mm-hmm.
He says, quote, "The SASC, that's the Senate Armed Services Committee, simply has not ability to oversee the trial of this case in particular or trials by court-martial in general," period, end quote.
Which is technically true, but realistically it's not true at all.
And we can point to 2 3-star generals that you just mentioned, Franklin and Helms, who found that out in a very acute way not too long ago. Is that correct?
Yeah. And these are, I believe they were both 3 stars at the time. Am I right about that?
Yes, they are. They were both 3 stars at the time. Franklin reverts back to 2. Helms just doesn't move forward.
Yeah, she just withers on the vine.
Yes.
These are two senior officers in the Air Force who were convening authorities, who were given the ability in military law for decades to act as convening authorities act. And, you know, when they act in a way that pleases the government, there's never any problem, is there? When they do what the prosecution wants, when they do what the other commanders want, when they do what law enforcement wants, that's a pretty good way to keep your career going.
Right.
But these two officers, had the temerity to exercise their convening authority in a way that benefited an accused. Okay? And at the time, that was perfectly legal. Congress has decided, oh, well, we don't like that possible result, so we're going to take away a convening authority's ability to review the findings and sentence of cases involving sexual assault. They did that in these two cases, and they were on the fast track for promotion, as I believe. Helms certainly was.
Yeah, Lieutenant General Helms was going to take over Space Command. She was going to be the first female commander of Space Command.
Yeah, she had been on space shuttle missions. She was an astronaut. I mean, it's difficult to imagine a more qualified Air Force general than somebody who had done that, you know. Her career is over. Why is her career over? Well, she was, you know, essentially punished by Congress's ability to oversee promotions, to oversee, you know, jobs for senior officers. They decided, well, we don't like what you did, and so...
Yeah,
your
so Lieutenant General Helms, she has a case come across her desk of an airman who was convicted of sexual assault. And she believes that case was wrongly decided by the members, by the jury. And she overturns that conviction.
Which is perfectly legal for her to do.
Had been since the inception of the UCMJ and even before that.
Right. And in fact, exactly. And it is just as legal, for example, for a convening authority to ignore an Article 32 investigating officer's recommendation. That's just part of the way that system works.
That's their ability to give clemency in cases that they deem appropriate.
Right. But unfortunately for them, they did so in a climate where Congress wants to appear tough on sexual assault and tough on the military justice system for its alleged failures in that area. And
I think this is where because what happens to Lieutenant General Helms is precisely what the judge in the Bergdahl case fails to even consider. I believe it is Senator McCaskill from Missouri. She just puts a hold on Lieutenant General Helms's promotion.
Right.
So it never comes up for vote. Nothing happens. She just says, I'm putting a hold on that. So the Air Force can only deal with a hold for so long before they just need a commander that's going to go command, you know, Air Force Space Command. There's space
and
stuff going on.
And Senator McCaskill does
space
not have
stuff
the...
is a legal term, Brian, if you didn't know that.
Yeah. You know, Senator McCaskill is not doesn't have near the authority that Senator McCain has.
Right. She's not the head. She's not the chair.
Yeah, but she's not the chairman
of that committee.
Exactly. But the very sad stories of General Franklin and General Helms illustrate why, again, if you know that they got punished because they had integrity. It's a lot easier to let your integrity slide and, you know, again, make decisions not based on the evidence, not based on the facts of the case that's before you, but based on, you know what, I don't want to end up like General Franklin and General Helms.
Yeah, and General Franklin's case was nearly identical. It was a sexual assault by one of his subordinates that he overturned. And he paid the price and lost a star for it.
Yes.
So for the judge in the Bergdahl case to say that the Senate Armed Services Committee or the Congress in general has no power, I think that that's just a flat dodge of the reality of – or just reality.
It is. And General Franklin and General Helms were mentioned in the defense motion.
Yes, prominently.
Their names do not appear anywhere in the military judge's findings of fact. In my personal opinion, because, hey, that's an issue that I can't honestly deal with. If I deal with it, if I'm the military judge and I deal with that honestly, then this case might disappear and everybody will be upset and I'll make, you know, CNN. And next time I'm up for promotion, I might not get one.
Or I just might get moved to a bad place. I think people,
there's all sorts of ways you can skin that cat if you're
right. People forget that we can just get moved to, oh, Diego Garcia needs a janitor, and I think
Barstow.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, to focus on the hyper-technical Well, it's not unlawful command influence because Senator McCain is not a member of the military, ignores the issue of, is there extrajudicial pressure being inappropriately brought to bear on our system? And the answer to me seems obviously yes. Senator McCain could have kept his mouth shut. Senator McCain is smart enough to have kept his mouth shut. Senator McCain is not unfamiliar with military justice, and he knows that the comments of senior folks can have a severe impact. General Amos didn't know that or didn't care. I think the evidence is better that he didn't care when you look at some of the things he did afterwards. But it's astonishing to me that Senator McCain didn't say something to the effect of, we're certainly glad Sergeant Bergdahl is home. There are issues here that need to be investigated, and I have every confidence that they will be. Boom. That's all you have to say.
And the other problem with the military judge's ruling is, if he wants to get hyper-technical with the law, Senator McCain is also a retired member of the regular armed forces receiving retirement pay, meaning that he is subject to the UCMJ still. So that he's making statements about a pending court-martial in a manner that he's not allowed to because he's still subject to the code.
Yeah, and I think that's also hyper-technically true. Would they ever, would he ever be in a position to actually have operational authority over, over an active duty military member? No, I mean, I don't think so. I don't think that I can't envision a realistic circumstance where they would bring him back on active duty. But I definitely still think that this huge elephant in the room has to be addressed. And the defense brought it up. I mean, Gene Fidel made that very clear in his motion. The military judge doesn't even address it. It's just like he is scrambling to get to the your motion is denied and doesn't address every issue. And I hope they bring it up again. I mean, that's why you file a motion for reconsideration, say, hey, sir, you dealt with 1, 2, and 4, but you forgot number 3 completely. Let's talk seriously about number 3.
Yeah, and especially for the average citizen who maybe hears about one court-martial, one military justice case per year or every 2 years, that we would want a much better showing in such a high-profile case.
Yeah, I think so, because this is going to be scrutinized, and every time I address this issue, and I've had to deal with UCI in other areas and other cases, and it's just very demoralizing, because you don't when you're a citizen on Main Street, USA, and you send your son or your daughter to serve in our military. I mean, what could make you more proud than that? If you're the average flag loving, American, I would be enormously proud if my daughter chose to join one of the services,
or even the Navy.
Even the Navy, I know.
No, I agree with you.
You have to believe they're going to be treated fairly.
Absolutely. And you and I, we don't relish this. We wish that it wouldn't occur at all. But to put our heads in the sand and pretend it doesn't happen doesn't help us either.
No, it doesn't. And it's, when you I hate like hell to say this, but it's the truth, so I'm going to say it. When you send your son or daughter to serve in our military, you are putting them in harm's way in the form of a court-martial that may not be fair. A false allegation that can literally happen to anybody, you need to believe that that's going to be treated fairly, and that if it's false, it's going to be found out to be false and everything's going to be fine. And that these types of considerations never enter into it. The thought of sacrificing an individual accused on the altar of something other than this is the evidence in your case that proves your guilt, that is unconscionable. And I think that anybody should see it as unconscionable.
Brian, that's your last word for the day. where can our listeners follow you on social media?
I am not on Twitter that often, but when I am, it's
They're going to be mad about that. They love Twitter.
it's jagdefender.com.
Okay.
Is my website. My Twitter handle is at jagdefender. And I invite anybody to come and chat me up.
They're good. They're good about that. They're really they give very insightful questions, and I will make sure to put all your contact information in the show notes. And we look forward to having you again. And thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Now it's time for one of my favorite segments of the show, Saved Rounds and Alibis. This is where I take questions and try to answer them from you, the faithful listener. This first question comes from Tracy F. Quote, my question since even serial was the government checking previous job history. His time should have showed up in some government database since he was paid at least a couple of weeks from the Coast Guard. Or am I missing something? For context, Tracy gives this excellent question in regard to Bo Bergdahl. That is an excellent question, and I'll give you an excellent answer right after we listen to that clip from Serial.
I think the following will likely be a question at Bo's court-martial. Did the Army screw up by accepting Bo, by deploying him to Afghanistan? Just to remind you, Bo was separated from the Coast Guard in 2006 after he became overwhelmed and had a breakdown during basic training. The Army, in order to enlist him 2 years later, would have to waive its usual standards, which it did. So the question actually is, did the Army recruiting process work like it was supposed to? Bo's separation from the Coast Guard wasn't labeled a psych discharge on paper, but that's essentially what it was. So did the Army miss something? We talked to a retired Army psychiatrist, Dr. Elspeth Cameron Ritchie. She was deployed all over. She was chief of forensic psychiatry and also of inpatient psychiatry at Walter Reed. And she was psychiatry consultant to the Army Surgeon General, the top mental health advocacy position in the Army. Dr. Ritchie's assessment of how all this went down with Bo? She thought the whole thing sounded pretty normal, like standard practice. The fact that the Army didn't have all the details about Bo's hospitalization in the Coast Guard, not uncommon. She said getting access to more detailed medical information, especially between branches of the military, in this case Coast Guard and Army, was hard because the military's network system wasn't so hot. Information sharing was incomplete. But she also didn't feel like anything we told her about Bo's Coast Guard situation would have been disqualifying even if the Army had known and had sent him for a mental health evaluation, as the Coast Guard doctor had recommended. Even if Bo had been assessed by, say, an Army psychiatrist, Dr. Ritchie said it probably would have been one session, and unless he showed obvious outward signs of psychosis or something like that, you're really depending on the potential recruit to self-report any psychological problems. So it's quite possible Bo would have been okayed regardless. At the end of the day, Dr. Ritchie told us, the best assessment for whether someone's going to make it in the Army doesn't happen in the recruitment office anyway. It happens during the sustained high-pressure test of basic training. And Bo did really well in Army basic training.
First, when addressing those comments from Dr. Ritchie, it's important to remember the maxim from military life, but life in general, that with position comes responsibility. Dr. Ritchie's curriculum vitae is laid out, stating that she was the chief of psychology for two different sections at Walter Reed. Walter Reed, at the time, was, or still is, the preeminent medical facility for all of the military. It's headed by the Army, but it includes all of the branches. In fact, Walter Reed has now moved to Bethesda, so it's Walter Reed at Bethesda. That's important because it is what we in the military call a PURPLE organization, meaning that it is joint. It includes all of the different services. Dr. Ritchie was also the psychological consultant to the Army Surgeon General. That's described as the top mental health advocacy position in the Army. This is why her position is important. She's not a lowly clerk. She's not someone at the bottom of the rung, just kind of doing the day-to-day work. Maybe someone that's young, inexperienced. She is either in the position to, or has the ear of the person who is in the position to change these problems she later identifies in that discussion. She says the practice of letting someone in Bergdahl's condition in is pretty normal, standard practice. Let that sink in for a second. So it's pretty normal, standard practice to let someone into the military who's been previously identified and disqualified from military service because of a mental health disorder. She also says, we are not good with networks. She served at the preeminent joint hospital in the Army. She should have identified that shortcoming. Again, this is not some lower level, entry level position person who is saying, oh yeah, we didn't really work well with the Coast Guard. She was in a position to change that. Dr. Ritchie goes on to say, it would not necessarily be disqualifying if the Army had known about Bergdahl's previous separation from the Coast Guard. Not necessarily disqualifying. Think about that again. That she's saying that if another branch of the military had disqualified someone for a mental health issue, that wouldn't necessarily keep you out of the Army. She then states that you would, for the most part, rely on self-reporting. Self-reporting. For those of you who haven't been in the military, or have maybe been in a different military, when you join the U.S. military, it is not simply walking into an office, signing a piece of paper, and shipping off to boot camp. It can take months. There's rigorous physical testing. When I went in for my initial testing, there's x-rays, there's EKGs, there's blood draws. It takes quite a while. It can even be much longer for somebody who's going to be a pilot or aviator. And the idea that we would rely on self-reporting, we don't do that with communicable diseases or broken bones or an EKG. I didn't just come in and say, you know what, my heart's really awesome. No, they hooked a bunch of wires to me and then they checked if my heart was awesome, which it is. The same with communicable diseases, or diseases in general, let me say that. They drew blood. They wait for lab results. Another issue here that I think is very difficult for people to understand, and I'm not saying that I completely understand it, though I have had a number of clients with psychological issues. They're relying on the person with psychological problems to report psychological problems. You don't always know that you have psychological problems when you're suffering from psychological problems. If that is the screening mechanism that we are using, Dr. Ritchie should be reflecting on her career in the mental health service for the United States and see how it's lacking. Okay, let's do one of those little imagination games here for a second. Pretend that Bo Bergdahl went into the Army and he had the plague. And he infected his entire unit in Afghanistan with the plague. Many of them got very sick. Possibly one or two of them could have died. But there were definite ramifications for him having the plague. And he had previously tried to join the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard had identified that he had the plague and didn't let him in because of it. And now Dr. Weyrich, after donning the accoutrement of the medical practice, including that stethoscope and that I would bring back that little thing that goes around your head, and then it has kind of a, it's a kind of a crescent-shaped reflective disc. You don't see that enough in doctors these days. I would definitely bring that back, and possibly a monocle. And I come onto a show and I explain in my expertise, yeah, we don't really keep good records. We don't really test for the plague. In fact, we rely on people with the plague to self-report. So, yeah, we maybe could have found out that the Coast Guard said he had the plague, but our record keeping isn't that good. Would that be enough? Would you rely on that statement? Because that's just the same as what Dr. Ritchie is saying. Finally, Bo Bergdahl was eventually diagnosed by an army team of psychiatrists, or psychologists, I never get those right, with schizotypal personality disorder that he suffered from at the time of the offense. So it's reasonable to conclude that he also suffered from that at the time of enlistment. So if we have a screening process in the military that doesn't screen out people with schizotypal personality disorder, that's a problem. And for Dr. Ritchie to say, ho-hum, pretty normal, standard practice, we're not that good with networks, we just let him in, is, in my opinion, as a physician, or a fake physician for this moment, that's inadequate. Issue number 2, Shadow McClain. Please go to my personal Twitter feed. That's at James W. Weirich, James Weirich. Or the Twitter feed for this show, that's at Podcast MJ. Please look at that. It's been 45 days. By the time this episode comes out, the Shadow's been missing. Please repost, even if you are one of our great listeners in far off lands. You never know who might be reading your social media feed. That's all. Thanks for joining me again today, and we all owe a great debt to Brian Bouffard for giving us this interview today. I've got to thank everybody who's behind making Military Justice. First, executive producer Dennis Robinson. You can find his Twitter handle in the show notes for this episode. Please follow him. He's currently engaged in an Iron Chef-like battle with Rabia Chaudhry. Next, the lovely and talented Brooke Giddings. And I really couldn't even attempt to put this podcast together without her. Also, she has her own podcast that I can't recommend enough. It's called Actual Innocence, and it is the story of individuals who have been exonerated through the Innocence Project. In each episode, she interviews someone who has been exonerated, and they tell their story, usually from their arrest, through their trial, imprisonment, and now what they're doing in life. It's really, they are very moving and important stories. And finally, there's my Uber producer, Dreadnought. He's always got my back. Weirich out.